Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The verse is which? Okay. 42. Kadamba champakashoka. Karanja bakulasanai. Kunda mandara kutajaish. Chuta potair alankritam. Karandavaik plavair hangsaih. Kurajair jalakut kutaihi. Sarasaish chakravakaischa. Chakurair valgu kujitam. Kadamba champakashoka. Karanja bakula sanahi. Kunda mandara kutajaish. Chuta potair alamkritam. Karandavaim plavair hamsai. Kurajair jalakukutai. Sarasaish chakravakaischa. Chakurair valgu kujitam. Kadamba. Kadamba flowers. Champaka. Champaka flowers. Ashoka. Ashoka flowers. Karanja. Karanja flowers. Bakula. Bakula flowers. Asanahi. By asana trees. Kunda,
kunda,
kunda.
Mandara,
mandara. Kutajahi, and by Kutaja trees. Chutapotahi, by young mango trees. Alankritam, adorned. Karandavahi, by Karandava ducks. Plavahi, by plavas. Hamsahi, by swans. Kurarahi, by ospreys. Jalakukutahi, by waterfowl. Sarasahi, by cranes. Chakravakahi, by chakravaka birds. Cha, and chakurahi, by chakura birds. Valgu, pleasing. Kujitam, vibration of birds, sounds. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lake Bindu Sarovara was adorned by flowering trees, such as Kadamba, Champaka, Ashoka, Karanja, Bakula, Asana, Kunda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with pleasing notes of Karandava ducks, plovers, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, chakravakas, and chakuras. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. For most of the trees, flowers, fruits, and birds mentioned here are surrounding Bindusarovara Lake. English synonyms cannot be found. All the trees mentioned are very pious in that they produce a nice aromatic flower, such as champaka, kadamba, and bakula. The sweet sounds of waterfowl and cranes made the surrounding area as pleasant as possible and created a very suitable spiritual atmosphere. Spiritual atmosphere is an atmosphere in which everything is directed for Krishna's pleasure, for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. Kanta Paramapurusha. There is one enjoyer, one hero in the transcendental realm, and that is the personality of Godhead. Krishna in his original form in Goloka, and then he has his vilas expansions for varieties of different kinds of pleasure in his various abodes, as Narayan, as Ramachandra, as Krishna again in Mathura and Dwarka. And then all the different Leela avatars of the Lord have their abodes also. But in every one of those abodes, everything that is present is meant, everything there is meant for Krishna's glory and his pleasure. It's not that only Krishna gets to enjoy, that everyone else is oppressed and deprived. That we find in such situations in the material world, that one man monopolizes the enjoyment and the control, and everyone else suffers under his oppression. We see that so many times. Therefore, we're shy, we're afraid to approach an autocrat, a domineering person, because he'll crush us, he'll oppress us, he'll cheat us. But Krishna is not like that. Although he's Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, he is the supreme autocrat. But he's also Suridam Sarva Bhutanam, the well-wishing friend of everybody. He likes to share with his friends, and everybody is his friend. So his opulences and his facilities for enjoyment are shared. Everyone enjoys in the spiritual world. Everyone is delighted. No one is oppressed. No one is deprived. Krishna is fed so opulently. But it's not like, that the starving masses outside of Nanda Maharaj's palace have to suffer while Krishna stuffs himself. No, everybody eats nicely in Goloka. Everybody. Even the forest-dwelling aborigines, low-class people, they get nice prasadam. Everybody does. No one's hungry. Even here in earthly Govardhan, basically no one is hungry. We don't, we have a few beggars, but they're mostly coming from the outside to sit down on a busy weekend and collect several hundred rupees for doing nothing. And if they put on this Gaudiya Tilak, then they can get even more. Yeah, easy pickings. No one's starving here. Other parts of India, there are people who are very poor, but here, Govardhan feeds everybody nicely, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of the villagers out in the country, they're not eating so well. But generally here in this town, people are eating well in the immediate vicinity of Govardhan. Nobody goes hungry. And certainly in the spiritual world, no one is deprived of anything. Everybody gets what more than they can imagine for enjoyment. So even though everything's for Krishna's enjoyment, everybody enjoys. Everybody's happy and satisfied. Not only satisfied with poverty, but there's no poverty. We have to undergo poverty to get Krishna, because we're materially attached, and we like to use everything for our exploitation. We go to the places, we're attracted to go to the places where there's facility for material exploitation, for sense gratification. We'd like to go to Las Vegas, to Disneyland, to who knows where you can enjoy, where you can use everything for yourself. You collect money so you can manipulate things and people. for your selfish enjoyment. And every place you go, you want to go shopping. You want a shopping mall. You want to buy things to stuff yourself with, to show off, to aggrandize yourself. That's the opposite of the natural condition of the spiritual world, where everything's for Krishna's pleasure. So, therefore, we're not attracted. We want to go to the material places. We want to enjoy and exploit. And therefore, we don't want to go to the place where everything's only for Krishna's enjoyment, where there are no shopping malls, no McDonald's, no place to aggrandize yourself. But that's actually where we should go. Bhagavatam is trying in various ways to attract us to the real world, to the natural world, where the focus of everything is Krishna. This is Bindu Sarovara. I guess it's located, where is it actually? Somewhere in Orissa. Bindu Sarovara? There is Saraswati River there? In Orissa?
No.
It's not in Orissa? Oh, it's in the west.
It is in the Himalayas.
Oh, there's Bindu Sarovara in Himalayas. Okay. Sure. Okay. Anyway, it's in the material world, but it is one of the manifest abodes of the Lord. Lord Vishnu shed his tears at that spot. And therefore, it's a spiritual place. It's a expansion of the spiritual world. And there, the spiritual atmosphere is manifest for those who can see. Even Vrajadham is arranged in such a way that although it is non-different from Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world, Vrindavan on the earth has one different quality, that materialists can enter it. When Krishna was present, even, so many demons who wanted to kill Krishna entered Vrindavan. Of course, they were all easily destroyed by Krishna. But the fact is there that they could enter. And now, 5,000 years later, anybody with a little money in his pocket and who can figure out how to get there, which is not hard, can enter Vrindavan. Anyone can take a train, a bus, a car from a taxi from Delhi or from wherever he's coming. And easily, so many trains are going to Mathura every day. Anybody can come. For 500 rupees, you can come from any part of India. So many materialist people are entering Vrajadhamma. Some of them are building their houses there and living there. But the Dhamma is not polluted, and they're not actually entering the Dhamma. If you enter Krishna's abode for a continuation of your material life, for continuing to use everything for yourself instead of for Krishna, then you have not actually entered. It is explained, I don't know where, but there is a special potency of the Lord called Praudamaya. She's also present in person in Navadvip, although that's not the original location. I think they moved her from somewhere else. This Praudamaya is there in downtown Navadvip. She is the special feature of Yogamaya who keeps materialists from actually entering the Dham. She creates a film on the surface, membrane, on the surface of the holy Dham, and materialists are sitting on that surface, and they don't actually contact, they don't touch the actual transcendental ground of Vrindavan. If we come here to try to use one particle of the dust of Vrindavan for our own selfish purposes, we will not be allowed to contact that dust. We won't actually, our feet will not touch the ground of Vraja. We will sit on the film of Praudamaya. To enter, you must have a mood of service to Krishna, that's all. The mood may be not perfected, may not be completely pure, but it must be there. Otherwise, you cannot actually enter. Sadhakas can enter, and they can practice their service. Then they're most fortunate. Srila Rupa Goswami strongly recommends doing this. He doesn't say that only Paramahamsas should come to Vraja. He says that this is one of the five angas of sadhana Vaidhi Bhakti that is most strongly recommended. Mathura Mandale Stitihi. So come. Come to the Krishna's abode if you want to do service. If you want to practice learning how to become Krishna's pure devotee, then come. This is a very great opportunity, but be careful. We should, while practicing our service, try to avoid aparads. Because aparads are very serious when committed here. Whatever we do is much more potent when everything we do for Krishna's service, but anything we do against Krishna's service will also be magnified. Aparadha. Rad means to worship. So anti-worship. Something you do that is the opposite of what will please Krishna. Something you do that displeases Krishna is called aparadha. Although in modern Hindi, I don't know about Bengali, but in Hindi the word aparadha means a crime. Something against the law of the country. Different idea. The idea has been shifted. Also in Bengali, the aparadha means crime. Yeah. But that's not the proper definition of aparadha. You know what? Because in one jurisdiction, in one country, it's a crime to do one thing, and in another place, it's not a crime to do the same thing. It's relative. And it's just based on what serves the purpose of the government, or the country, the nation, or doesn't. That's not a very perfect understanding of crime or of aparadha. To be a complete materialist may not be a crime, according to the mundane standard. You know, to be a complete materialistic pig is completely selfish. But as long as you don't break the laws that are in the books, you're an upstanding citizen. And another man who, just because he's starving to death, his children are starving, he steals some sabji, he's a criminal. You know, he steals some small thing just to feed his family. He's the big criminal. And the materialistic pig who has so many lawyers to keep him out of trouble, so that even though he's doing so many horrible things to so many people, nothing he does is technically a crime. It's all legal according to the books. This is bad definition of who's criminal and who's not criminal. Crime or aparadha really means to displease Krishna, to do what doesn't please Krishna. And Krishna is a person. He has his pleasures and his displeasures. There are things he really doesn't like. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was very tolerant. Krishna was not so tolerant. Krishna and Balaram marched into Mathura, you know, all fired up to kill Kamsa. And anyone who stood in their way, they just destroyed. They saw some man carrying nice clothes. They said, give us these clothes. And when he wouldn't give them, Kamsa's, that was tailor? Or washerman? Dobi. You know? He refused to give. This is the king's clothes. What do you mean? And their response, Krishna and Balaram, was to knock his head off. To kill him. So this is criminal behavior. You come to some city, and somebody doesn't give you something that you demand, and it's not even, you have no right to it, and you kill the man in the street. You know, that's a horrible crime. Yeah. But Krishna and Balaram, from the absolute point of view, this is their glorious Leela. This is a servant of Kamsa, who deserved to be killed. And it's Krishna's pleasure. Whatever pleases Krishna is good. And whatever displeases Krishna is aparadha, bad. So we have to redefine, we have to understand in a proper way what's bad and what's good. We should try to understand what pleases Krishna, because this is the absolute standard of good and bad. If we don't understand, if we have no understanding of what Krishna wants and what he doesn't want, then we'll never know what's right to do and what's wrong to do. We won't know it by studying the law books, or even by studying the Dharma Shastras. Arjuna was very expert in the Dharma Shastras. Being a Kshatriya, he was trained up in these things, Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. He read. I'm sure he read. No, he didn't read Chanaka, because Chanaka lived after him. But whoever wrote Dharma Shastras for the Kshatriyas back then, he read the Artha Shastra, the Dharma Shastra. And he was quoting from them when he argued with Krishna in the first chapter of the Gita. You know, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out that Arjuna's arguments were coming from the Dharma Shastra and the Artha Shastra. And Krishna didn't accept. Ashochanam Vashochas Twam Pragyavadams Jidbhashase. You're speaking such learned words, quoting from the Dharma Shastra, Artha Shastra. So many sophisticated arguments, like a lawyer. But look at you. You're lamenting for like a shudra for what shouldn't be lamented for. So what kind of pundit are you anyway, Arjuna? Anyway, don't you remember that you were cursed to be a eunuch? So don't become a eunuch again. Now he's really teasing Arjuna. You want to insult somebody? Try to remember what really makes him embarrassed. What thing he did in his life that he'd like to forget. So Arjuna was a eunuch for a year, and had to be the dancing teacher to the girls in the court of Virata. Something he'd rather forget. But here, in front of the battlefield, Krishna is remembering, hey, Arjuna, don't become a eunuch again, refusing to fight. So there's your punditry, big pundit, but you're actually you want to go teach dancing to the girls again? So Krishna is not satisfied with Arjuna's arguments. Arjuna has so many sophisticated legal arguments. Why? Trying to kill Drona and Bhishma is a crime. But Krishna says, no, you don't understand the definition of crime. Aparad is what doesn't please me. So if you don't fight, I won't be pleased. If you fight, then I'll be pleased. So that's what's right and what's wrong. We have to learn that also. Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam are provided to teach us what Krishna wants. We learn about his personality. We can learn, especially when we get to the 10th canto, and read how Krishna is pleased by his loving devotees in Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka. We want to know what doesn't please Krishna, read the other cantos about the material world and how it's bad and how it doesn't please Krishna. The attitudes of the material world. Read about the demigods and how even though they're authorized servants of Krishna, they do things that are aparad. Aparads are committed by demigods, by materialistic people. And we read about them in the earlier cantos of the Bhagavatam. And then in the 10th canto, and other places also, but especially in the 10th canto, we read how Krishna's devotees who are free from aparad, how they please him. Thus, in both ways, positive and negative, by positive examples and negative examples, what to do and what not to do, we learn how to become free from aparad by learning how to please Krishna. That's the whole science of devotional service. Just like you want to get something from an important, powerful person, you got to satisfy him. Whatever it takes, a bribe, some flattery, something else that he wants done, you do it. To get his pleasure and then get what you want. So dealing with Krishna is similar, although it's not corrupt like that. It's not a degraded process, but it's the same dynamics. You want something from Krishna? You want his lotus feet? You have to please him. And you want to know how to please him? Okay, the books are there, but you also have to take guidance from Guru and Sadhu. Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, these three. They're the ones who will tell us what Krishna wants and what he doesn't want. If we only take the Shastra and understand it with only our own intelligence, we're likely to come up with the wrong ideas. We'll get so many smart ideas about what we think Krishna wants, and they'll be wrong. Just like Arjuna, before the battle, had so many smart ideas of what he thought was right and wrong, but Krishna told him, no, You've got it, you don't have it right. So we need guru and sadhu also. Spiritual master to guide us through the understanding of the instructions of Krishna and about Krishna in the Shastra. And the sadhus. We need to associate with devotees and take their opinions seriously also. We can't always go to the spiritual master with every little question, bother him with every minor question or doubt in our life. So we have the other devotees. There are the sadhus. We can call them our shiksha gurus. We have so many gurus. Every godbrother is a guru. And they will, from them we learn. Rather than take the dictation of our own mind, we take the opinions of the Vaishnavas in understanding what Krishna wants. Then we have a hope of success. We just have to learn what Krishna wants and what he doesn't want and follow that instruction. Okay, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu.
Here in the Purport, Prabhupada uses this expression I heard before, pious trees. Can you explain this?
Yeah, well, pious trees are trees that do good for others. Padabrito. They're helping maintain other living beings. Well, a tree, what can a tree do for other people? He can't, you know, walk and he can't talk, but he can provide fruits. That's most pious tree, is fruit-bearing tree. A tree that bears some edible, palatable fruit, that's the most pious. And then you could even grade them according to the what the fruit is. You know, mangoes might be higher up on the list than some other fruit. And then a tree that doesn't bear fruit can still be pious in a lesser degree if he at least gives shade. That's also nice. People on the road get hot under the sun so the trees can shade them. That's also a service. Or you can sleep under a tree, protect, you know, gives you some shelter. These are services. Trees who don't provide fruit or shade are not pious. And trees that simply bear thorns and people get stuck by them are simply causing trouble to people. They're impious. So it's created generally by the practical service that the tree gives. Okay? Anything else?
Krishna killed in Vrindavan the demons. The demons are still in Vrindavan and they drink also Jamuna water.
After they're killed? No, I'm sorry.
No, before.
Yes.
Kansa, everyone is staying in Vrindavan.
Yes.
And they're telling
they get benefit. Even if you come and you're sitting on the Yogamaya membrane and you can't really contact the Dham, still you get benefit, even by indirect contact. You get Krishna, you get darshana, you get prasadam, you drink the water of the Jamuna, and so on. Even though the spiritual contact is not really there, even dim reflection of it, even an indirect contact. That's Krishna's mercy on the demons. Yes.
And you feel from all the
material. Yes.
And still, when the Krishna is present, and so many people they saw, and the demons saw Krishna.
Yes.
And they didn't change the.
I think the liberation, I don't think the Shastra is lying, or whoever said that, I don't think they're lying. It's just that it doesn't say when they get liberation. It may not be, it won't be immediate necessarily, it may not be in this lifetime. Someone by performing some devotional service and seeing Krishna is also devotional service. Taking his darshan is also an act of devotional service, just seeing him. But if you're committing aparads, then you have to first suffer the reaction of the aparad, which may take many lifetimes. If you commit very serious aparad, it can take 700 lifetimes. And then after the 700 lifetimes of suffering from your aparad, then you get your liberation. It can be like that. I say that because devotees in Vrindavan asked Prabhupada specifically about the Babaji's who were chanting this wrong mantra, Gornitai Radhesham Bolo Hare Krishna Hare Ram. They asked, are they going to go back to Godhead? They're chanting Krishna's names. And Prabhupada said, yes, after 700 lifetimes. They suffer for their aparadha, then they go back to Godhead. Like that. The liberation is guaranteed, but it can be delayed for some time. First you have to rectify, and then you get the promised liberation. Yes.
If someone saw the Krishna, yes. The Dwapara Krishna came, and someone saw Krishna, but he don't know he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Right.
And he saw the Krishna, and if someone saw the Krishna form.
Does it say? I don't remember. Does it actually say in the Bhagavatam or some shastra that anyone who sees Krishna is automatically liberated?
If someone sees Krishna, he will not see the material world.
Okay, but that statement is unspecific. It can mean that you can get liberation from seeing Krishna, not that always you get liberation from seeing Krishna. I think there has to be, you have to see with love to get the full benefit. I think so. If that's a statement, in a prayer, Krishna's called Abhavadarshanam, doesn't necessarily mean in all cases automatically.
Yeah.
You have to have the right attitude. Actually, that's fact. Because it is explained by Rupa Goswami, by Jiva Goswami. Where is it? I guess Laghu Bhagavatami to Rupa Goswami. And he's discussing what is said in the Vishnu Dharmottara Purana about the demon Jayavijay, the two brothers. They took three births. It took three births to get liberation. And the point being made by Srila Rupa Goswami is that Krishna gives liberation to the demons he kills, not other avatars of Krishna. The same demon who was killed as Hiranyaksha took birth again as Ravana, and then again as Dantavakra. The first two births, even though they saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead and were killed at his hands by Lord Varaha and then by Lord Ramachandra, that demon didn't get liberation because he had no attraction, real attraction to the Lord, no love. So, saw the Lord, and not only that, but got killed by him. But without any love, he didn't even get liberation. He just got another better birth. Material benefit, although also spiritual benefit that he got to associate with the Lord and get killed again. And only Dantavakra. Not Dantavakra, I'm sorry, Shishupala. Shishupala had the benediction, he could insult Krishna 100 times and not be punished for it. By that intense meditation in hatred of Krishna, he became eventually attracted to Krishna. That happened, the actual awakening of his attraction happened at the Rajasuya sacrifice after he had insulted Krishna one time too many, 101 times. The 101st time, his benediction was used up, so Krishna killed him. And as he saw the Sudarshan Chakra coming to slice off his head, his attraction to Krishna became awakened at that moment, and he got liberation. So that explanation by Rupa Goswami, based on the Vishnu Dharmottara Purana, is that only seeing the Lord with love, and it has to be Krishna, not some other lesser expansion of Krishna. Does a demon get liberation? Devotees, the ones whose devotion is awakened, they always see Krishna with love, even when he's not present. So they certainly get liberation. But a materialistic demon, just seeing Krishna, if it's not with no love, then the liberation is not bestowed. That's the actual explanation. Benefit is there, but not liberation, not yet. First you have to awaken some attraction to Krishna. But if you see him and keep on seeing him, you'll become attracted. So these materialistic people, let them come to Vrindavan. Let them come do the Govardhan Parikrama. By repeated seeing, by repeated darshan, eventually they'll actually become attracted. That's their salvation. That will save them. They shouldn't come and stay here, but let them come and take darshan and go home and come again and again and again and again. Then eventually they'll become attracted. Okay. Yes.
I'm wondering that that when Shishupal and Dantavaka came as the third incarnations of Jayavijay, that seems like they're relatively lesser or impotent demons compared to, like, say, Jarasandha and Banasura and Bhumasura.
Relatively, because they're living at the end of Dwapara Yuga, where everything is diminishing very much. You know, people in general were much more powerful in the previous age, in Treta Yuga, Satya Yuga. So because they're living just on the verge of Kali Yuga, therefore they're small demons. Relatively big, but much lesser than they used to be. But the opulence they really have is the opportunity for Krishna's intimate association. That they got. To participate in Krishna's pastimes.
But usually, like, in their previous two, like, they were, like, the biggest around at the time.
And yes.
In the case of Dwapara Yuga, Jarasandha was there, Banasura.
Yeah, Jarasandha was bigger than Shishupala. Shishupala was big enough to be a friend of Jarasandha. He was up there. He was powerful for his time. Not the biggest. You know, there's a hierarchy of demons also. Not everybody can be the biggest demon. They had their turn in the Satya Yuga. Now they're diminished, in effect. Their material life is going down, but their spiritual life is going up. Shishupala, yeah. Shishupala had much more intimate association with Krishna than Hiranyaksha did. Hiranyaksha didn't even know who Krishna was. He was just looking for a fight. You know, just another person to fight with. But Shishupal knew Krishna from his very infancy. Krishna came to see him when he was just born and gave him that benediction. So he had intimate association with Krishna all his life. Hiranyaksha didn't. So that his spiritual life was advanced, even though his material life was you know, decreasing. His material opulence. That's his great fortune. Kali Yuga, demons are very puny. They're able to cause trouble to other puny people, that's all. But if they met a real hero, they couldn't stand up to him. The big demons of Kali Yuga. Okay. So we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Bye.